Welcome to The Liberated Life, the podcast for women who are done pretending that they have it all figured out and are ready to live with more freedom, clarity, and courage. I'm Lucy Maeve, your guide on a journey through the unspoken parts of healing, desire, and self-discovery. This is a place to be seen, heard, and held, where we embrace all the complexities and contradictions of being fully alive. No masks, no shortcuts, just the real work and real liberation. Hello, my darlings. We are back. It's always such a joy to be here. I honestly find this podcast so nourishing. So I'm so happy that you are back with me. And today we have our first interview episode. My intention for this podcast was always that we would have little chats, just me and you, and then I'd also bring in some wonderful guests because I have some really incredible people in my community and people I've met over the years who I want to gift you because they have so much wisdom and so much magic to share. So today's guest is my wonderful friend, Alex Croxford, who I met in a sound bath in Mexico City, and we bonded over the fact that we had curly hair, although let's be honest, my curly hair seems to have disappeared since I've moved back to London, which is weird. Anyway, Alex is a transformational love and relationship coach who helps women heal after betrayal, release shame, and come home to themselves in love. Her work is rooted in somatic healing, emotional repair, and deep relational truth. After navigating infidelity and a divorce of her own, Alex now guides women through the same journey she walked, back to self-trust, intimacy, and a love that actually feels good. This conversation is so important because both of us have recently come out online about our own experiences of the taboo-ness of her having had an affair, me having been the other woman. And we're really talking about why people cheat. So talking from Alex's perspective of her own journey of having cheated on her husband, understanding the root of shame, how we transmute shame, how we can use those experiences of the icky things we do to actually grow and evolve, and what it really takes to be in healthy, loving relationship, both with ourselves and with our partners and the people around us. It was such a joy to record this with her. I hope that you enjoy it as much as I did. I'm sending you so much love, and I will speak to you soon. Okay, my lovelies. So we are back for our first interview podcast, which feels really exciting for me because I've just been chit-chatting with you guys since I launched this podcast on my own. And now I get to chit-chat with one of my friends and you guys simultaneously, which is really exciting. So as I mentioned in the intro, I have my friend Alex here with me today. Which feels like such a gift. And I am so excited for this conversation because both of us have been on a journey in the last 2 months, 2-3 months really, since both of us have come out with some pretty taboo topics on the internet. And it felt like a really important conversation to be having. So my intention for this is to really go into some of the grit and the dirt and the mess of being a human, as always. And to bring some of that stuff to light. And Alex is an absolute queen at a lot of this work. So I'm super, super excited to dive into this conversation. So I've already given the background about you having cheated and come out on Instagram about having cheated. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's necessarily important for us to go into like all of the depth around what was going on in your marriage at that time. But I want to know to start with, I can imagine in that experience of like having cheated, experiencing all of the shame around it, feeling the grossness, like what the hell do I do? What was like in my mind when I think about that experience or what I imagine that experience to be, there are like two different paths that you could go down. You could be like, this thing has happened. I'm either going to just be like, oh, this is awful, and I'm either going to pretend it didn't happen and just go down into this like pit of despair, or you use it as an opportunity for growth. And I wonder for you, what was the turning point? And was there a moment where you were like, I'm just going to go into a pit of despair?
Oh my God, it's such a good question. So I actually tried to forget what I had done initially. I spent almost 2 years thinking that I could forget about it. I could move on. I wanted to stay with my husband. I didn't want to leave him. I loved him. I hated myself, but I still didn't want to end the marriage. And I was so scared of telling him and so scared of what it meant about me and so scared that he was going to reject me that I just tried to push it all down and carry on with a smile on my face. But after 2 years of trying to do that, and I was in the pit of despair, secretly in a pit of despair, because in my marriage, he had no idea what I was going through. And 90% of my friends, even some of my best friends, had no idea what I was going through. So, because I was so ashamed and I was so terrified of being rejected by them. So I was very secretly in a pit of despair. I'd find myself in the toilets on my own crying with, you know, very tight chest, like on the brink of a panic attack, not really knowing that I was on the brink of a panic attack, just thought I had a pain in my chest. I even understand it was anxiety, if I'm honest. But after, it was nearly 2 years, just over 2 years potentially, that I had tried to forget what I'd done, tried to push it away, tried to forget about it. I kept hoping that with time it would just evaporate. And it got to a point where I was still Googling all the time, you know, am I a bad person? Should I tell my husband? What's wrong with me? Can people heal after affairs? Can relationships survive after having affairs? Like, I was on Google all the time trying to, you know, it's before the time of ChatGPT, so I had to just Google it. So I was constantly Googling, trying to get the answer. Of course, there is very little support for the person that has actually been the one that's cheated. There's a lot of support for the person that was cheated on, but very little for me. And I honestly didn't know what help I really needed. I just was in such a hole. I was like, someone has to get me out of this feeling of like this weight on my shoulders, this tightness in my chest, this feeling of, and I couldn't name it as disconnection at the time, but it was disconnection. Like, I would be at parties with my then husband and my friends, and I would have to be faking it. Like, I was faking happiness. I was faking togetherness. Because inside I felt so broken. And at the same time, I was going through like infertility, IVF. So there was so much going on, but I was just suppressing it all to try and keep the peace, basically. And it just got to a point where I just couldn't carry on like this anymore. It was totally unsustainable. It was starting to impact my work, my health, my skin around my eyes was starting to get really red and dry and blotchy. And obviously the infertility was also going on in the background, which was also causing me so much stress. And it just got to a point where I was like, I just need some help. And I don't know where to turn. But like, just as the universe would have it, I had been following this woman for a while, and she was talking about feeling her emotions. She was talking about after a miscarriage, actually, bizarrely, and she was really talking about things in ways that I'd never heard anyone talk about before. But there was just something in me, and she kept talking about the mind and heart disconnection, like not being in your heart. And although at the time I was still not aware that I was so in my head and I wasn't in my heart, there was something that spoke to me at a far deeper level where I just knew that she was the one that was going to help me. And as I started to I reached out to her, and I went to I did a retreat with her. But that was really the beginning of me discovering that how I was presenting to the world and this personality that I was living from and this story that I was living from wasn't actually the truth of who I was. And that was the beginning of a huge inner healing journey, which has brought us here today. But yeah, it was a moment of cannot go on like this any longer. I was swamped by, at the time, I didn't know it was shame. I knew it was guilt. I didn't know it was shame, but that's what I was really swamped by. And it was unbearable, so heavy.
Got it. Like, even as you're talking about it, I can feel my heart, like the heaviness around it. And I can only imagine like my own experience of, it was very different, I think. But I just remember my friends who knew that I was with this married guy, like periodically asking me like, what's going on? And I try and hide it from them. And I just be like, oh no, it's all fine. Like, we're not talking anymore. And they'd be like, you're lying, aren't you? And I was like, not lying. And just, eating me up inside. Yeah. And it comes to this piece about like, I've thought a lot about this since like putting that piece out on Instagram of like the identities that we hold for ourselves of being like good people and like the behaviors that we're like, I would never do that. And that was so clear to me in all of the comments on the reel that I put out, and I saw also on yours, like the like self-righteousness of like, I would never do this, I am a holier than thou person or whatever. And I have been thinking a lot about it because cheating is so taboo, and it's particularly taboo for women. And I don't, like, in my mind, like when I was in banking, there were a lot of men that were cheating all the time. And like, I was kind of aware of a lot of men on the floor that were like with other women. And it was kind of celebrated in a weird way. Like, not like, yeah, you're an amazing guy or whatever, but like no one ever, there was no sense of it being bad necessarily. And I wonder, like, from your experience of talking to other women and just reflecting yourself, like, why do you feel that it is so taboo for women particularly?
I mean, I think it's a lot to do with religious programming. And I think it's a lot to do with the denial of desire for women, and that it's wrong for us. I mean, there's so many layers to this. It's so nuanced, because actually, I don't necessarily think that women actually have affairs just because of desire. I think there is so much more going on. It feels like that, but it's really a desire for something beyond sexual connection. It's actually connection with ourselves that we're really craving when we cheat. But I do think that there is so much shame around women's sexuality. I think there's so much shame around a woman just almost expressing herself in a different way. I think so much shame because of religious programming about, you know, the whore, Madonna and the whore. There's like so much around us having to present as the good girl, as virginal, as I have not, you know, ever even had sex with another man. I mean, Andrew Tate at the moment is walking around telling everybody that, you know, women, unless they have not had sex with another man, they shouldn't be being married. You know, that's the level that we're at now, where it's like, I mean, I think the dude has got quite a lot of avoidance, because quite honestly, he's not going to find his wife in 2025.
He needs to come and hang with me.
He does.
The avoidance crew.
Yeah. Andrew, if you're listening. So I think, you know, there is this story around women having to be almost like a virginal in order to be acceptable for society. And so looking outside of your relationship is like the next level of horrifying to society. And I also think that, you know, it's that you're being the good wife. Men have this very, you know, it's like, or they have to sow their seed, or there's this, you know, belief that, or the story that, you know, men are here to impregnate as many women as they can because they don't know which one is their child. Look, maybe that is true to a degree, but it doesn't ever talk or take into consideration what a woman is lacking or desiring for herself in her love, in her love and in her life, that she's not actually getting within her relationship. And I don't think it's the same. I don't think women cheat for the same reason. In fact, I don't even know why men cheat. I don't even want to go into that. But coming back to women, I think it's just the societal story that anyone who hasn't just, you know, only slept with her husband and been the good traditional wife and stayed at home is a whore, a slut, a slapper. Like, there's so many more words for a woman who has been sexually explorative, promiscuous. I don't know what you want to, even the word promiscuous, you wouldn't use that for a man. You'd use that about a woman, really. So it's just like there's so many more negative connotations and so much more conditioning around what it means to be a woman, especially a woman who is not being the good wife, in inverted commas.
It's so interesting. As you were talking about that, something came up for me that I had a conversation with Thomas this morning about this, of like, I like got in contact with this part of me that's like deeply angry with men, like as a collective, that I am trying to work on. So I recognize that I hold a part of me that holds a lot of resentment and frustration towards men that is not entirely healthy, and that I sometimes project that onto him in our relationship. And the piece that came up for me when I really sat with it, and I was like in tears as it all kind of came, you know, when you break down into tears and like suddenly all the stuff like starts flooding into your mind, you're like, oh my God, this is what it's actually about. I realized that I was like, there's a big piece for me around this belief that we were conditioned with as women. And perhaps this is just my own experience, but this sense of like, I have to wait to be chosen by someone. And once I'm powerless in this situation, I have to wait, I will then be chosen. Once I've been chosen, I should be so grateful that like someone is in my life that I should just bend over backwards and not have any needs and not need anything and just be like, I'm so lucky that this man wants to spend time with me. Like, amazing that I then completely disconnect from myself and my own needs.
Yeah, I mean, I see that over and over and over and over. And that pattern is so common.
Mm.
And I think that like, I don't necessarily, personally, I don't blame men for it. I just think that it's actually how, I feel like there is something in it that it was so important for women to be a part of a tribe, so important for us to be protected by men when we would live, you know, on the Serengeti, for example, when we were hunter-gatherers. We were so vulnerable. We were once carrying babies, pregnant, breastfeeding. We didn't have the strength to defend ourselves. And I think that I've heard someone talk about this, and I believe there's probably some truth in it, that we, in order to stay within the tribe or stay protected by men, we began to learn these self-abandonment ways of being, like people-pleasing, like accept me, keep me here, protect me, and protect me at all costs. And I think that this has been passed down and passed down and passed down and passed down beyond, you know, obviously trauma that's happened in our lives, wounds from our childhoods that are making us behave in that way. But I think it's so familiar for women to abandon themselves and to feel like they should be grateful. The number of times I hear women say to me, well, you know, I think that maybe just having this breadcrumb is better than having nothing. And I have to, I'm like, I understand, because I did that too. Mm. I accepted breadcrumbs for years. Like, I thought that was love, which is so mad. Mm. And I was so afraid to speak my truth and ask for my needs and wants to be met because I felt they were too much, or I was too much, or I might be laughed at, or I might be rejected, or I might be told no for them. And so then I just continued sacrificing. And this is, and I don't actually blame men for it. I think it's just, I do think that there is something in women that we perpetuate our own problem. We watch our mothers do it. Mm. We watch our mothers self-abandon. They watch their mothers self-abandon. And even more so in the generations before us, where our ancestors weren't working, you know, they were so much more reliant on their partners to feed them, to keep them warm, to keep them safe, much more than we were. And so there was even more of a denial of self and what we want and need.
It's such a, like, I really see this pattern in myself from years ago around self-abandonment, that at times I'd tell myself like, but I can just, I'll be okay. Like, even when I was kind of aware that I was self-abandoning, like, it's okay. Like, I don't need that much. And da, da, da. What I didn't realize was, I love how Gabor Maté talks about this, about the, like, the primary needs being attachment and authenticity. Mm-hmm. And self-abandonment is when we're like really over-focused on attachment, so keeping people close. And this sense of like, okay, if I entirely focus on being attached to this person, like, it's okay. Like, it's all good. Like, I can just continue with this forever, right? But we forget that there is a force, very strong force, in fact, inside of us that will pull us towards authenticity. Mm-hmm. And what I see in myself and in other people, and I'm wondering whether this rings true for you in your experience, is almost like there's an elastic band that gets stretched and stretched and stretched and stretched and stretched. And then at some point it's like, I have to be true to myself. I have to connect to who I actually am. And it's like, bing, and then something bursts, affair happens, something else happens, meltdown, like to varying degrees of rupture in a relationship.
I completely, 100% agree with you. And I think, and that's, they're the women that are currently coming into my space where the elastic band has been stretched so far that they've ended up looking outside of their relationship. Mm. And it's really interesting because even then it's still so nuanced, and in each example, or each woman is still coming with their own, you know, version of the story, but they are all at the end of some thing that they might not have even realized that they were the end of, you know. Like, I don't think most women won't identify that they're self-abandoning until somebody like us reflects, perhaps you've been self-abandoning. Oh my gosh, I didn't realize, like, I didn't understand that's why I ended up looking outside my marriage. I couldn't make sense of it. Yeah. Because I actually thought I was happy. Like, I thought I thought I was happy. And that's what's so mad. But because I was so disconnected from myself, I didn't even know if I was happy or sad. I didn't even know if I was lonely or in connection. I had no idea.
I'm like, whenever you talk about this, being the forever single girl that's like very confused about how relationships work and is constantly trying to understand being in intimacy, how did you think you were happy?
I thought I was in a marriage. I was married. I'd had a lovely wedding. I had a good job as a television executive that I'd worked. I'd ticked loads of things off the life list. So that's why I thought I must be happy, right? Because I had the husband who we didn't fight all the time. We got on to the point where we were just both avoiding conflict 99% of the time. So it wasn't really an honest relationship. But in my mind, oh, look, there's pretty much peace most of the time. We don't fight. So therefore, we must be happy. I liked him. You know, we had fun together when we hung out with our friends. We had so much fun together, actually. Like, we both really said that. We had so many amazing fun times together, but they generally involved drugs, alcohol, a festival, and our group of friends. So it was like that. And, you know, we were able to have conversations that weren't of any depth because I wasn't at any depth. Like, I don't blame him, but, you know, we didn't. And then when things started to go wrong, i.e. we realized we weren't able to get pregnant, that's when it started to become very clear that on reflection, not at the time, but now looking back, and we both reflected this, that our relationship was built on sand. Like, it didn't have the foundations it needed to be able to withstand huge life issues, such as going through infertility or betrayal within a relationship. Like, it did not have foundations for that.
My brain, whenever you talk about this, is so funny because on so many levels we're so similar and we've like been on similar journeys and stuff. Whenever you talk about this, I'm like, brain can't compute, because for me, being in a relationship is like the most mind-bending thing of like, just like, I have anxious, avoidant, like constant whirliness. I don't feel that I am conflict avoidant, so I will very much be in conflict with people and feel kind of okay with that. So I can't understand when you talk about like, oh, we just like went along and like kind of, I don't know, coexisted or whatever. I'm like, but how? Like, I don't, my brain is like, tell me how this works, because I have so many, all of the people that come to me are like dating people and it's like super anxious and like getting into really intense conversations, like diving into stuff and like constantly in these cycles. I'm like, yeah, that is my world. And you're like, yeah, we could just go along and just coexist. So I'm like, how? Tell me how. Well,
like, I think the thing is that I was so disconnected from how I felt. Like, I did not know anything other than happy, like, as in, and not genuinely happy. Like, all I knew was positivity. Like, I barely cried. I think I cried in front of my ex-husband, I can remember once for sure, and I'd had too many margaritas in a bar in New York. And like, I can maybe remember, like, it's a handful of times in 10 years before the me telling him about that I cheated on him. So I was so, even I wouldn't, like, crying at the end of a film for me felt like so embarrassing. I was so afraid of vulnerability, like terrified of vulnerability. And it was like we coexisted really well. I think that's a really good way of putting it. And we didn't touch on, you know, the depths of our own emotions. We didn't have emotional intimacy. We weren't able to talk about how we were truly feeling, because quite honestly, I was so disconnected from it. So it was like, there was no, as I said to you, like when I first started, when I cheated on him and I was walking around the street with this like contraction in my chest, this pain in my chest, I had no idea what it was. I was like, what is this pain in my chest? And it had to be my coach that said, that's anxiety in your chest. That's fear in your chest. I didn't even know, like, I couldn't. And so, almost like after I did cheat on him, it felt so normal to just continue to be disconnected, if that makes sense. Like, it was just,
it's almost like there wasn't another world in your mind. There wasn't another world that existed.
No,
it was just like, this is the world that we exist in. Like, this is what a relationship looks like. There's no other blueprint. And
no.
Partly, I don't know whether this is true, partly because maybe from what I've understood about you, you have slightly less attachment wounding than me and mm-hmm. some of the people that I work with, that there was less like, whoa, relationships bring up so much stuff that it's like I'm like forced to look at myself because there's so much intensity going on. It's just like, oh, we can just chug along together. But your self internally, capital S self, is dying in the process.
I think that's exactly it. Like and even if I was having all of those, you know, big feelings of anxiety or fear of abandonment or fear of rejection, I would just suppress them. It would just be like, push them down, smile on your face, carry on. Right. Like there was no space for me to even, like, the partner before my ex-husband was that was an absolute classic 4 solid years of self-abandonment. Like, and it culminated in me finding out that he'd been sleeping with his ex-girlfriend for the whole time we were together. I mean, to be fair, he cheated on his ex-girlfriend to be with me. It was an absolute clusterfuck, like a relationship in your 20s that was just like, had red flags all over it. Like, it was just the giant red flag. And then we wonder why.
But it's so funny because when you talk about it, I'm there, like the girl in her 20s, looking at all the people in relationship in their 20s, being like, what is wrong with me? I want to have that thing that they have. Why am I always alone?
The amount of times I say to my clients, never compare yourself to people in relationships. Oh my God. I was in a terrible relationship. We were on and off for 4.5 years. He wouldn't let me meet his children because apparently his ex-girlfriend was so, you know, like, no, it wasn't. It was because he was still shagging his ex-girlfriend. Anyway, that's by the by. But for that 4 years, I ignored my intuition that was telling me there was all sorts of things going on. Mm. I suppressed. Whenever I did bring it up, I was met with, you're mad, you're seeing things, you know, this is not true, which fed the belief still that I had to, that I couldn't trust my own intuition. Feelings. I couldn't trust my intuition. I couldn't trust my gut. So it's like, that was the proof I needed to continue to abandon myself. And I thought I was the problem. I remember reading books like Women Are From Mars and Men Are From Mars, Men Are From Venus. I thought that I was like the problem. And I mean, I was 50% of the problem. We co-create every relationship we're in. And I co-created my part of that by abandoning myself, ignoring my intuition, ignoring, not actually saying how I felt. Like, it was a fucking awful relationship. People were trying to warn me out of that relationship all the time, but I just ignored them and ignored myself because I wanted to be in a relationship more than I wanted to be alone.
Yeah. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the like myths around cheating. And like, I noticed when I came out and said that I had been the other woman, that a lot of the people commenting were calling me like a whore, homebreaker, narcissist, slut. Like, someone said that I was like a human fleshlight. I was like, nice. So I want to talk a little bit about, like, if I asked you, are people that cheat inherently bad, what would you say to that?
No.
Why?
Because, okay, they are not inherently bad. But people who've cheated, I would say, carry a story that they are bad inside. And cheating is, because of the way that it's deemed in society, as you know from your reel, as I know from all of the trolls that I've had since posting about this on Instagram, including, we should bring back stoning, I hope you die, I hope your current partner cheats.
What was it, like, your monthly bleeding or something? I was like, I'm not okay with this.
What did he write? Oh, yeah, people were like saying, oh, thank you so much for sharing this, you know, supportive of this carousel that I'd written about why good women cheat. I think it was that one. And this guy wrote something along the lines of, oh, it's just an echo chamber of cheaters, just a bunch of cheating monthly bleeders. You're all narcissists. Wow. First of all, you don't know what narcissist means. But second of all, like, just please go and deal with your mother wound. So what my belief is, no, we're not inherently bad when we cheat, but I really believe that we carry the story that we are deep down. And that's why we end up doing something that society deems to be so abhorrent, that we must be terrible people. And so therefore that proves the story to us that we already carry deep, deep down, that we are bad, or that we are disgusting, or that we should be ashamed of ourselves, or that we are wrong or broken. And so many of us carry that story, especially the good girls. Because the good girls and the perfectionists have become the good girl perfectionists as a way to mask the fact that deep down they believe that they're bad. Mm-hmm. And that survival mechanism is incredible and will get us high achieving, will get us jobs in the city as executives and TV, as lawyers and, you know, all of the bankers, all of these amazing achievements. But really, it's like we're trying to run away from a core belief that we're actually not good. Or good enough, both of those things, really.
So why would we end up behaving in a way that would prove that we were bad?
Because our unconscious belief is such a strong belief. It's a story. We're literally coming from the context that we're bad. And that stems in our childhoods. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if we were smacked, if we were ashamed for a moment of, I don't know, self-expression, if we were told off by the teacher in front of the entire class, if we were bullied by an older sibling or other friends in front of other friends. So this like, there must be something wrong with me is a decision that we make very, very young. And it can be from so many different spaces, including not having needs met by our own parents. But normally it can be around the shame of who we are at our very core. Like, I must be so wrong that I got hit by my parent, even just once. That is enough to make you believe that you are wrong at yourself. Just being screamed at one day. And this isn't to blame our parents. They were doing the best that they knew how. It's just in that bang, that frozen moment of time, in time, that child makes an instant decision. I must be so bad inside that this is why somebody is behaving like this with me. It's not safe for me to be myself. It's not safe for me to be the fullest expression of myself. Perhaps we are shamed around somewhere along in our sexuality as well, which is at the very essence, our core, who we are. We're these creative beings with this sexual energy. And that comes online around the age of 6 or 7. And so anything that we have been shamed around the core of who we are, the human begins to now create an entire mask to protect that part, or deny that part, hide that part of ourselves. So we become the high achiever. We become the good girl, the one that gets it all right, that becomes the head girl at primary school, that becomes, you know, the one that gets straight A's. That, because actually, if I achieve, if I am good, if I am seen to be perfect on the outside, then no one actually has to see inside. Because if they saw inside, they'd see the truth of who I was. And then if I'm rejected for the truth of who I was, which I believe is wrong and broken and bad, then I'm dead. Like, I'm done. And so now it spills out. And that's how it ends up happening. And that's how we end up having affairs. Because it's like, we can't mask that belief anymore. It's almost like the disconnection from ourself is so strong. Mm. And that story that's running our life is so strong. We're literally still coming from the story that I am bad. Mm. And so when we're coming from the story that I am bad, we will look for evidence, unconsciously look for evidence that we're bad. And what's one of the worst things, in inverted commas, we can do as a human is cheat on somebody that we love. And therefore proving the story that we carry deep down about ourselves, which is that we are bad, we are broken, we are wrong, we are disgusting, and we don't deserve love.
How much do you think identity plays into it? Because I was recently thinking about like the idea of, like, when we act in weird and funky ways, as we all do, we're trying to meet some unmet need inside of ourselves. And sometimes that is trying to meet the need of like the expression of a part of us that isn't finding a route of expression in our life or in our relationship. Because I've sometimes wondered, like with cheating specifically, like if you're in a relationship with someone and there are certain aspects of yourself that you can't fully express for whatever reason, or you're not in connection with, it could be like a very strong, because of this drive for authenticity and this like inherent drive to be fully ourselves, there's got to be a strong pull to be like, I need to find somewhere in my life where this part of me can be seen and can be fully expressed. And it was something that I thought about a lot in relationships generally, and like my micro relationships I used to have, when someone said to me, like, when we end a relationship, oftentimes, like, yeah, in part we're grieving the loss of the person, but we're also grieving the version of us that we were allowed to be in that relationship. So like, who did you connect with in yourself in that relationship, and who are you allowing yourself to be? So I wonder, in your experience, who are you trying to be in that relation, in the affair relationship? Or if that doesn't resonate, then...
No, I think it really does resonate. I think if I'm honest with you, I see this with so many of the women that come into my world now, and they say they're grieving the relationship that they had with their affair partner. I didn't actually have that experience because I never was in love and wanted to leave my husband. I always was like, I don't know why I'm doing this, but I don't want to leave my husband for you. But oftentimes it's exactly the same thing. I'll say to the woman who is struggling to recover from the grief of the ending of the affair so that she can stay with her husband. And I will ask her, well, who was it that you were being in that affair? Like, what part of you were you able to express that you don't feel safe to express, or you're not expressing in your marriage right now? Because that's actually what you're grieving. It feels like it's the person, but really it's the version of you that you are able to tap into. And I think what happens, well, I see what happens, is that when we're in our actual relationships, there are parts of us that we feel like we have to hide because perhaps they're not lovable, perhaps they're too much, perhaps they're too sexual, perhaps they're too, I'm too in touch with my desire, perhaps I'm too confrontational, perhaps I'm too, and it's almost like, so we hide all these parts to stay attached, like we did as a child, to our husband or our long-term partner in some way. And then the affair partner, or the partner that's outside of the relationship, it's like we don't feel like we have to necessarily hide so much of ourselves because there's not so much at stake. It's like when people say, why do I feel like I can be more authentic with my friends than my romantic partner? It's because at the end of the day, there's not as much at stake. The heartbreak of a friendship breaking is equal, if not more, by the way, of an actual relationship ending. But that's a side note. But it feels less risky. It feels like there's less on the line for me to be myself with my friends than it is for me to be myself in a partnership. And actually, another thing I would say is most of us don't even know who we really are. We have no idea who we really are until we start doing this work, until we realize, shit, I've been really disconnected. I am performing a version of me that I think is lovable. And that was like my biggest wake up as I started to do this work. I was performing being in a marriage. I was performing love. I was performing a version of me that I thought was acceptable.
God, I see that so much. Like I feel like I have like a very strong authenticity radar in my body and mind. And I feel like I've kind of been able to sense it since I was very young. But the performance in marriage and performing being an adult, performing being a high performing person, performing being in a relationship. And it's almost like this is the script that I now read from, because now I am a wife, or like now I am a mother. Now it's like, this is the identity that I now step into, which is like, okay, cool. We're constantly evolving an identity. It's like, but who actually, sometimes I want to go up to people and like knock on them as if they were a door and be like, hello, like who, what's actually going on in there? Like, because this all feels like a performance.
Oh my God, totally. And I don't think people even realize they're doing it. Most people don't realize they're doing it, because society has created these very well-trodden lines, grooves, railway tracks of what the next step is in life to be a successful adult. And this is why I think a lot of people start to have midlife crises in inverted commas, because they get to the age of 40. They've gone down the route of, okay, so I've got the career that I was meant to get. I have the wife or the husband that I was meant to get. I've bought a house. In fact, I've bought two houses. We've moved into a bigger house now. We've had an extension done. We've had two children, or we haven't, whichever way we decided to go. And now what? What? Is this it? And I think is when people start to get, you know, cycling addictions. That's why you see so many middle-aged men in full lycra now, because they're like, well, there's got to be something else, because this isn't bringing me the happiness that I have been promised by society if I did all of these things. And I think it is, we're performing being a human, because that's what we've been shown. We're shown on adverts, we're shown in films, we're shown in television, we're shown in books, we're shown in love songs. Like, this is how to be a successful human. And in order to be a successful human, this is the very well-trodden path everybody's trodden before, and now you just need to take it and you're also going to reach happiness. But I'd like to say that I don't think many people actually really turn around to anybody in their like 80s or 90s and they're like, which part of your life really would you say brought you happiness? Because I could guarantee most of them aren't going to be like, oh yeah, it was following the path everybody else told me to.
No, I mean, what is it? One of the biggest regrets of the dying is not having lived a life that was true to myself.
Exactly.
But it's so funny you talking about this performance thing. I remember having a conversation with a friend years ago about this, of like, I had just started to understand the idea of like us living from a conditioned mind and like all the stuff about living from scripts and whatever. And I had this weird realization that I was like, I think some of the things that I say in conversation with people aren't even what I think. They're just like, I've heard them on a film. And this, like, that this is what I should say in this situation. Like, I remember going through like micro breakups with people, not having any idea about how to like compassionately go through the ending of a relationship, and saying things like, I don't think you ever loved me. You just loved the idea of me. And then I'd be like, I don't even think that that is true. I just think I'm repeating what I heard on a film. And like, then I started to think, I was like, are we doing this all the time? Like, is everyone just like repeating what they saw on Notting Hill?
I think they are. I actually think we are. Because you know what? You know what's so crazy is that just because humans, just because we know, or we think we know how to love, and going a layer deeper, deep down, our very essence, we are love, right? That's the core of all beings, human beings, is that we are love. We understand, because if we were lucky enough, obviously some of us weren't, to grow up in a family where we did feel love to whichever degree was necessary, we do understand the experience of love. But just because we understand the experience of love does not under any circumstances mean we know how to be in relationship. Not one bit. But this is the mistake that we make, is that we think we do. And we're all so arrogant because we think, well,
I watched a Disney film. I know how it's meant to be.
Exactly. I know the prince is meant to rescue me from the castle, and then we're going to ride off into the sunset. We're going to have children. We're going to have a house in the country and white picket fences, and then we're going to be happy forever. And it's like, no, because relational work, it's the truth of conscious, intimate relationships is brutal. Like, it's really hard because it reflects back our deepest wounds from the past that have not yet been healed. And so, yes, when you are more connected to yourself, like, this is my own experience of the intimacy that I have with myself now, in terms of how I know myself, how I can express myself. And I am still a work in progress. My God, this is never ending, by the way. I'm not healed. There are still many places for me to learn. There is still so much for me to peel back and discover about myself and about love. But what I am here now, standing 8 years long from the point where a nuclear bomb went off in my marriage, the intimacy that I have with myself now, that the authenticity, the understanding of who I am, the relationship that I have with my emotional expression and with my own truth is reflected back by my partner to me now. And it's like, that wouldn't be possible if I wasn't where I am right now. And I'm not saying, as I said, that you have to be healed to be in a relationship. Like, there are still shit that comes up in my relationship now that I'm like, oh, still need to work on that, then haven't healed that wound. Oh, that really triggered that part of me. And you know, that's a something right there. Like the other day, I don't know whether this is appropriate for the podcast, but we're going to do it anyway. But like, I've got a big bum, right? If you've never seen me, I have got a big bum.
She's got a very sexy bum.
Thank you. But I grew up in the 90s where having a big bum was not okay. Like, we grew up with, you know, Claudia Schiffers, Naomi Campbells, Kate Moss, you know, the women on Desperate Housewives. If you watch Desperate Housewives now, they all have the same body. Massive boobs, no hips, no bum, flat stomachs. So that was the era I grew up in, on top of my own disordered eating that I had many years and all sorts of other shit that was going on in my relationship with my body that I hated. I always wanted to be as skinny as I possibly could. Like, that was as small as I could meant the best I could. Anyway, now I have obviously a much better relationship with my body, and my bottom is now bigger than it was when I was younger. And Adam loves to say, like, he'll talk about my big booty and how much he loves my big booty. And the other day I had to say to him, baby, please can you stop calling it big? Because it's actually really triggering to this part of me that believes that big is bad. Like, I can't, this wound around my body is so strong that even though you are feeding me with such beautiful words and so much words of affirmation, and you're literally expressing your love for me and my body, the wound in me around my self-image and the shape of my body is being triggered. And he, and it was like, I was able to explain that to him because I could really, I could see it. But it's like that, that's an example of how in your relationships, it's like, even when they're not meaning to be mean, they're actually being beautiful and kind and loving, it can still trigger a little part of you where it's like, oh, that really, like, why is that? Why does that hurt so much when they do that? Or why do I want to run when they tell me how much they love me over and over? Or why do I want to do this? Because it's like, that is a part of you that doesn't, that yet hasn't been healed. Like, yeah, there's a, that trigger is a window to a part of you that is still wounded.
Honestly, like, my whole thing was like, how, recognizing the pattern of how much I will pick fights when we've been very close. Like when we've been in really close connection, that then somehow I'll end up picking a fight. And we were talking to our couple therapist about various other things yesterday, but she was talking about exits and like the exits that we all subconsciously have in relationships. This idea of like how we basically move away from intimacy as a way to protect ourselves, and like how we were looking at how we individually do it. And my one is like, it doesn't, I would have thought in my head, I was like, this is an empowered thing to do. Like in my head, if like my partner's having a bad day, I'm like, well, I'm going to go out for a walk and I'm going to go on my own and I'm going to listen to a podcast and I'm walking along and I'm like, see, I'm great. Like I'm good on my own. I'm like, good. I don't need him. Da, da, da. She was like, that's an exit. I was like, why is it an exit? And she was like, because you're trying to avoid the fact that he's uncomfortable by walking. And I was like, okay, so what would be the like evolved thing to do? She's like, it would be to sit in the house and go, I'm really noticing that I feel incredibly uncomfortable with the fact that you're having a bad day. And I'm really noticing that I'm wanting to fix it and make it better, and to sit in that discomfort until it cracks you open. And I was there being like, but I'm so empowered and I'm looking after myself. And she was like, no, Lucy, you're exiting intimacy. And I said that, I was like, I don't understand, like, how do relationships work? Like, when there's so much going on beneath the surface, like, if we're just seeing it through the lens of, like, the superficial and the we are disagreeing about this thing or this thing is annoying or whatever, it's like, no. Like, and then you follow the thread and it's like you're going down this like huge long route into the earth and it goes like 10 meters down and you're suddenly in the realms of like some experience that you had when you were 5 at school and you got like asked to do a presentation and you forgot your pants or I don't know. You know, it's like,
yeah,
we're constantly dealing with the 5-year-old, really.
Oh my God, totally. Or the angry teenager.
Yeah.
Or like, it's crazy. And that's it. Like we think the problem is that they're not doing the washing up, or that, yeah, they're persistently, you know, I don't know, forgetting to take the bins out, or they're, you know, doing whatever. We think that's the problem and that's what we need to keep bringing up and we need to talk about that and that's the issue. And it's never about that. It's about what we're making it mean. Mm. We're making it mean that they don't do the washing up because they don't care about us, or that we don't matter, or that the expectation is we just have to do everything because we're not actually, we're not cared for, we're not loved. And where did that stem from? That did not stem from this moment now. This stemmed from a moment in the past, probably between the ages of 0 and 7, when you realized or you learned or you believed that actually you didn't matter and everybody else's time and existence mattered more than yours, or emotional expression mattered more than yours. Mm. So yeah, I completely agree. We are all completely fucked, relationally fucked. You know, I think, but also in that fuckedness, the potentiality for deeper intimacy and the experience of true love is infinite. Because when we can heal and we can see how much the wounds of the past are impacting both us and our partners as well, because otherwise we're just basically 2 5-year-olds trying to get attention from each other. Mm. And it's like when we learn to actually sit with our own 5-year-olds and soothe them and be like, that wasn't really about what happened just then.
Yeah.
And it's funny you say about that, like needing to always reflect back, what did you notice inside yourself in that moment? Like, yeah, that is such a huge part. And I had to do the same thing with Adam recently. My therapist said to me, like, reflect, tell him what the experience was inside of your body.
Yeah, without it's not the need about them him. To fix anything.
Exactly. Mm. And not blame him. It's not his fault, but you notice the experience of anger move through you in this particular moment. And that in itself is emotionally intimate. Because now I'm sharing with you what my experience was. And this is the mistake that we make, I think, so often, especially as women, is that we dump our emotions on our partner and we expect them to carry us. And there is a difference between emotionally dumping and being emotionally intimate. And that is like a muscle that you have to practice and learn. And it's a skill to master, actually, I think.
Well, because emotional dumping is like, it's the antithesis of emotional intimacy. Because to be intimate with emotions is to be like, ooh, like there's this thing that's happening inside of me. Like, what's happening? There's like this energy moving through me. It's shame or it's anger or whatever. And to be like, that is your primary relationship. In intimacy with your emotions. And then it's like you're reflecting to the person that you're in relationship with from a place of intimacy with what's going on inside of you. But when we're in emotional dumping, we're actually not in relationship with our emotions. We're in relationship with the story in our head, which has nothing to do with the emotions and has everything to do with how the other person is wrong or bad.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think this is it's the blame or the expectation as well that somebody else is going to rescue us from our emotional experience. That is a mistake we make a lot, and I see that a lot in the women in my world, where it's like, well, I felt sad and then he didn't feel as sad as me, or he didn't, or you know, I'm feeling anxious and he said this, and I'm like, but what did you want him to say? Like, what is it that you're actually looking for? Because no one can take away how you're feeling. No one. There is nothing that anybody can say. Yes, of course, if they have a regulated central nervous system, have a cuddle. Like, you can definitely help regulate each other, but they can't take your feelings away. No. There is nothing that anybody is going to say or do that's going to make that change. And you're absolutely right. It's the intimacy within yourself of being like, I'm really noticing a lot of sadness today. Yeah. Sharing that with the partner and then taking responsibility to be with the sadness and allow the sadness to actually be expressed in whichever way it needs to be for you. Maybe you need to go and have a really big cry. Maybe you need to go and lie down on the grass outside. Maybe you need to go and lean up against a tree or journal or listen to some music or dance with yourself, whatever it is. But it's the responsibility of your own expression is really important and not done enough.
Mm. What do you wish more women knew about shame? Because I know you do so much work with shame and with women who have done, well, who have betrayed partners and feel a huge amount of shame around it. If there was like one message that you had for someone that's experiencing shame, what would it be?
You're not a bad person, because shame at its very core is, I am bad. I am broken. And you don't need to live your entire life carrying the weight of shame for something that you've done in the past. There is another way to live. There is another way to be. You deserve love, even though you feel so unlovable. You still deserve love, even though you feel so ashamed of your past or something that you've done. But the only way to be able to experience true love, I believe, is to be able to really actually lean into the shame, like feel the shame, allow the shame to move through you and to not become who you are. And that's quite advanced for people that are like, what does she even mean? Lean into the shame. But it's the difference between experiencing the shame as energy in our body versus experiencing shame as the story that's running around in our minds.
Yeah.
And that's quite an advanced practice. But ultimately, that's how things begin to completely shift. Like, I remember there was a time maybe a year ago. I'll just tell this story because I think it's really helpful. This story was about a year ago, and I've obviously been doing this work for like years now and very practiced at this. But about a year ago, Adam and I were having like arguments about something in which I felt judged, da 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 da. It doesn't really matter the details of exactly what it was, but it was a recurring argument in our relationship. Was one morning talking to him on the phone, and he said something which was actually quite it wasn't really a big thing for him to say. It wasn't about what he said, but what he did say triggered this, like, I can only describe it as a tsunami of shame in my body. Like, it literally like rose up, and I could feel it coming. and we were on the phone, and I basically said to him, baby, I need to go because I need to go. I can feel like so much is moving like in my body right now. I can feel so much shame coming up. So we put the phone down and I went away, and I laid on the sofa literally in a fetal position for the whole day, like consumed by shame, like the experience of shame in my body. Oh, it was just, it was so heavy. It felt so tight. It felt so like disgusting. But what I knew because of all the work that I'd done on myself was like not to get lost in the story of my mind. Don't get lost in the story of that conversation I'd had with Adam, because it actually was nothing about that conversation. It was just that had triggered the already existing shame in my body. And so I was able to sit. It was very uncomfortable and it took me a whole day. And I allowed the shame, the energy of the emotion to move through my body. It took crying. It took journaling. It took, as I said, being in the fetal position all day. By the end, it must have been about 6 hours, it had moved. The shame had finally moved. And so then I was able to have a conversation with Adam at the end of the day where I was able to say to him, this is what was my experience today. And he wanted to have a conversation about the conversation that we'd had in the morning. But I was able to say to him, it's not about, it was not about that conversation. It was not about that. And that is real. That's like how we move through big emotional experiences without making it about the story of our minds and just the experience in our bodies.
And it's such a, I mean, it's such a head fuck for, I mean, for me, it was such a head fuck when I first started coming into this work. And it's been like, as a woman who was deeply emotionally constipated and like hadn't cried for 10 years, to start to recognize that like actually any decision that's made from intense emotionality is not a decision from your present, it's a decision from your past, and being like the actual key to all of this. And it's so basic, like there's so much that's said about healing and whatever. The crux of all of it is like, let yourself feel your feelings fully until you come to a place where you almost feel like you've had an orgasm and you've like completed the feeling. And then at that place, you're in presence. And in that place, what do you want to do? And like, I learned that so much from breathwork, because it was this like, you really, in breathwork, you really feel the like rise and fall of emotionality and how emotion is such a wave, in the same way that an orgasm is a wave. And you feel the point of completion, like you start to get quite intimate with that point of completion of an emotional wave, and being like, oh, this is truth. Like once this emotional wave has passed, I'm no longer in the processing of something from history. I'm now present. And from my present mind, what is true here? And I love to ask myself that question whenever I'm in spirals of my own, of like, once I have moved through an emotional wave, like what is true after the emotional wave? And always the answer for me is always like, life just is. Like it just is. We're just like floating through life, and we're on this river of this stream of life, and our only job is to let go and be okay with that flow. But we so often wanting to control and grip.
Definitely. And no one teaches us either that when you're in a big emotional wave, you don't need to be making decisions, or that you don't need to be having conversations even. Like that was a huge thing I learned in my marriage and with my ex-husband, about the do not, if one of you is triggered, don't have a conversation. Don't try and have a conversation. And fuck me, we could not get that right. I tell you. That takes practice to walk away in the midst of a trigger and be like, I just need to go and be with myself right now. I can't, like, I need to not have a conversation right now.
Because the desperation for reconciliation is so strong.
So yeah, and thinking that. Yeah, and also because we witness it on television all the time. In films, we see people screaming at each other, crying. You know, we have to have the conversations in this really highly charged,
and then like, it will suddenly be like, oh, we're now back together, and now we have amazing sex, and it's like, this is not healthy.
No, exactly. You're actually showing us incredibly unhealthy relational patterns.
Yeah. So I would love to ask you, as we come towards the end of this beautiful time. So a lot of the work that I do, as you know, is all about this idea of living a liberated life. And I want to know from your perspective, based on everything that you've studied and your own life experience and what you've moved through, how do you define your own liberated life?
Okay, I love this. I actually really feel that my version of a liberated life, and I feel like slightly eye-rolly as I say this because it's really overused right now in the personal development world, but I'd say it is a life of authenticity, like the truth, living from the truth of who you are beyond the story of the mind, beyond the story that you believed yourself to be and the mask that you have created in order to protect yourself, like that is a liberated life. Because when you know who you are, then other people can also know who you are. And that's freedom.
I love that. Thank you so much, my lovely. It's been such a pleasure to have you here. And if anyone wants to find you and work with you and all of your magical work, how can they find you? Is there anything you'd like to share with the crew?
I think just pop on over to my Instagram at I am Alex Croxford. And on there, you'll see what it is that I have on offer at the moment. I do bi-weekly softening sessions for anybody who has betrayed someone they love and they want to come into community and heal together. And I'm also running the second round of my new group program, The Healed Heart, which will begin in October, which is again for anybody who has betrayed or cheated on someone that they love and they want to remember that they are worthy of love again.
I love that. And I can vouch for Alex. She's also not a creepy, weird coach person like a lot of the industry. So go check her out, people.
I'm glad I'm not a creepy, weird coach person. It's only
sometimes I'm very eloquent and sometimes I speak like a three-year-old.
I like that, bring it. But I think that, like, you know, there's a lot of people that are not in integrity, and that is very important to both of us. Thank you
my darling. So that was it, my lovelies. I really hope you enjoyed that conversation. I hope that you feel inspired and connected with and opened up to new perspectives. Alex is amazing. I highly recommend her work, so go and check her out for sure. If any of you have any questions or anything that's coming up from this conversation, please feel free to give me a shout, and I look forward to seeing you back here again soon.